The fifth female lawmaker to officially enter the 2020 presidential race announced her candidacy Sunday. Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota joined the ranks of women to challenge President Trump. We're talking about the crowded field of Democrats vying for the party's nomination here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The field is more racially and ethnically diverse than any seen before. Let's listen.
I stand before you today to announce my candidacy for President of the United States.
I'm running for President of the United States of America.
I am a candidate for President of the United States of America.
Well, I'm going to run for President of the United States.
I am a candidate for President of the United States of America.
Announce my candidacy for President of the United States.
Democratic voters, do you hope to see a female candidate win the party's nomination for 2020? Who are you getting behind at this point? Republican voters, what do you make of this crowded field? Do you think President Trump is a formidable candidate against the Democrats vying for the party nomination? We're at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Laura Brown is an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Laura, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me on, Kate.
Well, just by listening to that montage, you just hear the number of people getting into this field of candidates. And Sunday, we heard Amy Klobuchar, U.S. Senator from Minnesota, as part of that voice montage there, becoming the first lawmaker from a Midwestern state to enter the race. There's been talk about her potential to win back Midwesterners who voted for President Trump. And she said she's making a trip to Wisconsin soon because, quote, there wasn't a lot of campaigning in Wisconsin in 2016. She said, quote, with me, that changes. How significant is Klobuchar's popularity among voters who know her when it comes to getting the party nomination?
Well, there's no doubt that Senator Klobuchar has been very popular in her state. You know, she won in 2006 a race against Representative Mark Kennedy and prevailed by 20 percentage points. And she has, once again prevailed in her races. So she is very popular. And I think she is someone who we will see over the course of this race gain a lot of traction in Iowa, which is a key first in the nation caucus state. And I imagine that she will appeal to a number of the voters who, in fact, defected from the Democratic Party to vote for President Trump in 2016.
But could all the talk about Klobuchar's Midwestern appeal be more of this East Coast mindset, kind of painting the Midwest with more broad brushstrokes in terms of what it wants in a candidate?
Well, I mean, I think this is where the real question for the Democrats is going to be, where does the party want to go and what do they want to represent? Do they want to focus on southern states and look toward, you know, North Carolina and Florida and Georgia and maybe even Texas? As we saw in 2018, there was an emphasis at the statewide level and at the House level in those states. Or do they want to go back to the Midwest and look toward, you know, Pennsylvania and Ohio and Wisconsin as being the states that they need to bring back into the fold? It's really a question of strategy, but it's also a question of ideology, and somewhat is wrapped up in kind of the symbolism and the demographics of who becomes the nominee.
Democratic pollster Mark Melman recently said that to succeed, each of these candidates has to distinguish themselves, and that's very hard to do when there are so many. And he went on to say that Klobuchar is going to find company almost everywhere she goes. Where do you see perhaps weaknesses in Klobuchar's candidacy when we look at her competition?
Well, I just think her biggest weakness is going to be appealing to ethnic and racial minorities. I think one of the realities is that when you look at the first four races in the Democratic nomination field, right, you have Iowa and New Hampshire, but then you also have Nevada and South Carolina. And in Nevada, the Democratic electorate is predominantly Hispanic, and within South Carolina, it's predominantly African American. And so when you look to those four contests, people like Senator Kamala Harris and Senator Cory Booker and, you know, Julian Castro may appeal in a much greater fashion to those electorates.
We're talking about the growing field of Democrats entering the 2020 presidential race with Laura Brown. She's an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see out of a Democratic presidential candidate? Would you vote for someone whose beliefs you closely align with, or would you vote for someone with whom you don't entirely agree but whom you think could beat President Trump in 2020? Flesh that out for us. Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. Laura, before Sunday, Senators Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Kirsten Gillibrand, and Representative Tulsi Gabbard had announced they were running for the Democratic nomination. And you said that you agree with some people's conclusion that Senator Kamala Harris is well positioned to win the Democratic nomination. Is that still holding for you? And can you tell us why?
Well, I do think that she is in an extraordinary position. First of all, she comes from a very large state where she will be able to raise a significant amount of money. She has already run statewide in California before her Senate race. She has a kind of a serious and substantial base of support there. She also has a background somewhat like Senator Klobuchar in being a prosecutor, and I think that that will be very appealing, that kind of temperament as a candidate. We actually saw both of those senators on the Judiciary Committee this last fall when the nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, was being sort of interviewed and was testifying. And I think what you saw was their ability to follow a line of questioning and very thoughtfully, you know, sort of draw out questions and testimony from him as a witness. And I imagine that that kind of logical conversation is going to do very well as they are attempting to make an argument in this campaign.
We saw them in their element, you're saying, at that moment.
Very well said. That's right. I need more coffee.
You say that party activists have traditionally been risk-averse when it comes to female candidates. When have we seen that, and how does that play out?
Well, I think one of the things to realize, and it's pretty striking when you think about it, is that in 1984, the Democrats chose Geraldine Ferraro to serve as the vice presidential nominee with Walter Mondale. And that was a race in which the Democrats were not likely to win. Ronald Reagan was very well positioned for re-election. They chose a woman, and then it just so happened that Ronald Reagan did win, and one of the kind of, you know, sort of analyses later was that Geraldine Ferraro was part of sinking the ticket. And I think just by the very fact that the Democrats, in all of those many years since 1984, have not sought to put a woman even as the VP on the ticket, when there have been exceedingly qualified women senators and governors who could have been tapped for that role, is pretty evident about how the parties have viewed women.
And Laura Brown is our guide. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute here on the Ideas Network. Democrats are lining up to launch presidential campaigns in what is quickly becoming a crowded field of contenders for 2020. We're talking about the field here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The group includes at least five U.S. senators. The latest, Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota, announced Sunday. Democratic voters, do you want to see a female candidate win the party's nomination? who are you backing at this point and why? Or maybe you don't have a specific candidate in mind, but just hope that any woman wins the nomination. Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Lara Brown stays with us. She's an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Let's go to the phones now with Troy joining us from Muskego. Hi, Troy.
Hello. I'm definitely for Elizabeth Warren. I think she's got a little more presence when she speaks than Kamala Harris. However, I do want to, my question is, and I felt that they should have done this last time too, why don't they ever combine, I haven't seen it anyway, after the primaries, I could see like if a Biden won or something, then combine that with Elizabeth Warren as a vice president. I think that would be a good strategy for a Democrat. I think they should do that.
Troy, thanks for the call. So looking at a combined ticket here, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren. Laura?
Well, what usually happens and what is very typical is that the person who becomes the nominee chooses somebody else who ran at the same time to be the vice presidential nominee. We can think back to Barack Obama picking then-Senator Joe Biden at that point to be his vice presidential nominee. We can also look back to John Kerry. When he became the nominee, he picked John Edwards, who had also been running that year. And that is fairly typical to choose someone who was already in the field, partly because that person has gained a tremendous amount of name recognition throughout this process, which is why most political observers look at all of these candidates and they say, you know what, some of these people are in some ways really running for vice president, not necessarily the top spot.
Troy brought up Elizabeth Warren, Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren, who announced her candidacy over the weekend. And she talked about how hardworking people were up against a small group of people who held too much power. And the solution was big structural change, not just a tax credit here and a regulation there. What do you see about Senator Warren's candidacy?
Well, I do think that Senator Warren is looking to pick up where Senator Sanders left off in 2016. She spent a lot of time talking about the rigged system and how the wealthy and well-connected are able to sort of do well in our society and others aren't. I think the real question for Senator Warren is that will that populism, that sort of angry populism, be as attractive in 2020 as it was in 2016. Many more people are actually enjoying a better economy. The unemployment rate is very low. And I do think there is this question about, can you rouse the entire electorate on a sense that everything is corrupt and broken, or do you need to rouse it with some sense of hope and optimism about what the future could be, not just about what's not working at the moment?
We were talking earlier about Geraldine Ferraro on the Walter Mondale ticket. Has Hillary Clinton's loss in 2016 affected the Democratic Party's willingness to put forth another woman from that perspective, because you brought it way back to Geraldine Ferraro in the 80s?
Well, I did, and I will just say that this is not a one-party thing. You can see the same sort of hesitancy among Republicans after Sarah Palin was picked to be the vice presidential nominee, and then how they saw women in the subsequent races. I do think that that this reality about sort of, you know, the woman is being asked to catch a Hail Mary pass, and then somehow she's blamed for the loss when she doesn't make the catch, is part of this problem. And yes, I do think that Hillary Clinton has been somewhat blamed, and I do think that there is an entire conversation within the Democratic Party about whether or not really there should be another woman leading the ticket, or whether it should be, you know, Vice President Biden, or whether it should be one of the other, you know, men who are looking to either jump in this race or who have been talked about, including somebody like Beto O'Rourke, who just lost his Senate race. But the idea that he should be then running for president, having only served in the House, is kind of extraordinary.
And this field of Democrats isn't just made up of women. There are men who have entered the race. We've seen Cory Booker. You mentioned Julian Castro. There is John Delaney, Andrew Yang. What do you see in terms of this broader field and not so much in this gender, perhaps, conversation we're having?
Well, again, this goes back to what does the party want to represent in sort of the person who they nominate, and how do they want to appeal to the new Democratic Party electorate? So one of the realities is that over the last decade, the Democratic Party has become a party of more women, of more college-educated voters, but also of younger voters and of more racial and ethnic minorities. And so it is, I think, to a certain extent, difficult for the Democratic Party to keep saying, yes, we should put two white men at the top of this party, when the entire party itself doesn't necessarily represent sort of white men.
Since 1968, there have been six incumbent presidents who sought re-election and their party's second term in office. Only one lost, Jimmy Carter. With this history in mind, how likely or unlikely is it that a Democrat will secure the country's top office in 2020?
Well, there's no doubt that structurally speaking and historically speaking, we would expect President Trump to win re-election. Embattled incumbents typically come back, and when they are a first-party term incumbent, essentially win a second term for their party. You know, as you just mentioned, if you look back in history, right, Ronald Reagan won, we could see Bill Clinton won, we can see George W. Bush won, as did Barack Obama. So here we are, facing this historical norm, which is that President Trump should win. But it's also the case that President Trump is in some ways uniquely vulnerable. He had a win that was, you know, very narrow. In fact, it was narrower than was George W. Bush's win in 2000. It's also the case that his win you know, really turned on the few states that, you know, where there is sort of a tradition of Democratic voting. So many of the voters that you would have expected to have turned out perhaps either stayed home or weren't appealing and were not interested in necessarily voting for Hillary Clinton. And finally, I think one of the other things that's true is that President Trump's overall popularity is much lower than any of the other presidents. So he is in a position where he does, in some ways, look more like Jimmy Carter than the other embattled incumbents. The problem is that Jimmy Carter also had a failing economy and he had foreign policy crises. And we don't have either of those uncertainties at the moment. So Trump is, in fact, still favored to win.
As we go forward, Laura, how will you see these Democratic contenders for the nomination? How will they address President Trump in their stump speeches and in their campaigning? How will they address the tweets?
Well, I think for now, they probably won't. Right now, their task is to differentiate themselves from the other Democrats in the field and to talk about why their candidacy is really the right candidacy for this moment, this time, and this election. And I think what will happen over time is that the primary argument that they will be making against President Trump is going to be a character one, not necessarily all of a policy one. For while I think most Americans who are Democrats, they do feel that the country is going in the wrong direction on the policy front, more Americans are aware of kind of the chaos and the character side of President Trump's tenure, much more so than the policy side, the deregulatory efforts, or any of the kind of stopping of climate change legislation or
and
any of
Laura, I have to stop you there. Thank
sure.
you for joining us.
No problem.
Laura Brown is an associate professor, director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. We've been talking about the large field of Democrats entering the 2020 presidential race. Coming up next, it's UW System President Ray Cross. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're talking about what it will take to renovate the UW's aging buildings and what the repair backlog looks like on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Most of the UW system's nearly $1.9 billion capital budget request for this biennium is funneled toward repairs and renovations. Think overdue HVAC, electrical, plumbing repairs, exterior work, the list goes on. Do you work on the UW-Madison campus? Did you experience the flooding? How is your department coping? Are you a UW employee? What facility repairs do you want prioritized? And what do you think should be addressed in the state budget? Are you faculty or staff or one of the recently restructured campuses? What would you like to ask President Ray Cross? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Ray Cross is president of the University of Wisconsin System. President Cross, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you, Kate. It's good to be here.
So we saw last week burst pipes, flooding damage, 28 UW-Madison campus buildings, including the one we're in right now, Vilas Hall. How is campus handling these incidents and the damage that has been caused?
I think we're handling that very well. I think there are over 1,000 sections right here at Madison that had to be moved. Sections of classes. And we got those up quickly, and I believe that almost all of them this week will be fully reinstated into their old room. So that's pretty impressive.
Have we ever dealt with an event of this size before at UW-Madison or any of the UW campuses?
Yes, we have. We've had several events, and we have emergency planning processes. We actually practice those, so this went off really well, and I have nothing but compliments for the staff and folks here at Madison who made this work so smoothly.
Is there money in the budget to address accidents like this? Surely insurance is going to come up on the other end of it, but what about this aging infrastructure?
Well, it's something that's important, I think, and all of this is coming to a head. And in reality, the cold weather, half of those incidences were a result of other things like construction going on, and some of the areas of the buildings were exposed to this weather. But the rest of it is that our buildings, so many of them, over 50% of them, were built shortly after World War II, and they're at least 50 years old, and they've just plain worn out in many cases. And the process of maintaining them and preventing these kinds of things just takes time and money. After the insurance is recouped and we recover some of that, obviously, we maintain some of that in our fund balances to obviously take care of emergencies pending payment from insurance companies. But it is always a problem, and it's chaos for students, faculty, and staff when that happens.
David Darling, the Assistant Vice Chancellor for UW-Madison Facilities Planning and Management, told the Board of Regents that there is a backlog of deferred maintenance on UW-Madison's campus, and the problems are increasing in frequency and severity. So how can aging facilities be addressed in the system budget? What are you doing there?
Well, that's why our request for capital funding seems large, or larger than normal. In part because we need to replace, repair, and renovate facilities throughout the system, and they were all built around the same time. Well, not all, but a majority of them were built around the same time. And that's important to maintain and not to, we're not trying to create a whole bunch of new square footage. Enrollment is pretty level with the exception of a few campuses. At the same time, to maintain this just gets more costly and more costly. And we've had a few years of zero money in terms of maintenance, and that's exacerbated the problem.
And so the backlog gets longer and longer on buildings that perhaps went up quickly in the 50s to the 70s, maybe not the most robust materials?
Well, they may have been robust materials, but they were built quickly, that's correct, and some folks think cheaply. But in reality, they've served as well for many years, and their lifespan, 25 to 30, 35 years maybe, and we're plus 50, so... It's mostly the mechanical systems. It's not the structural, although there are examples of structural problems, too, exposed rebar and eroding concrete, etc. But mostly mechanical problems, and whether it's pipes or it's electrical or it's some form of air movement, that's a problem. We build to different standards today than we did back then.
We're talking about aging infrastructure across the UW System campuses and what is being done about it. UW System President Ray Cross stays with us. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a UW student? What building repairs or updates do you want prioritized? What is your major? Have you been impacted by the closure of majors? What can you share about your UW experience? Call in at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So this is the time of year that the UW system budget comes together. A percentage of the budget depends on state funding. What are you prioritizing for the upcoming fiscal year?
Compensation for our employees is our number one priority, and we've asked for a 3% increase in the first year and a 3% increase in the second year. After many years of no increases or little increases, we think that's very appropriate since we're falling further and further behind compared to our competitors. That's our highest priority, and that it not just be 70% funded by the state. Because we've had our tuition frozen for 6 and it will be 8 after this budget, and for the two-year campuses, it will have been 12 of the last 14 years that they've had tuition frozen. So 30% of the compensation cost is typically absorbed through the tuition side. And since it's been frozen for so long, we're asking for 100% of that to be funded by GPR, state dollars.
But the UW system recently approved raising graduate student tuition at 9 schools and out-of-state undergraduate tuition at 6 schools. How are those decisions made, and will they make up a difference in the shortfall?
No, they won't make up the difference, but those are made mostly, almost exclusively, on the basis of market and cost. So you will see most of those, with the exception of one or two, which was really a market-driven increase. Most of those are at inflation or under inflation, thereabouts.
As you look at the legislature and you have Governor Evers, who has a background in education, do you think your budget requests will be looked upon more favorably due to his background?
Well, Governor Evers served on our board and is clearly familiar with the arguments and the rationale for funding our system. But I also think that the big factor has to do with the economy. The economy in the state is improving, and you're seeing state revenues increase considerably. And whether they are sustained or not is always debatable. But at this point, that's the most promising piece of this. And in conversations with Governor Evers and his staff, as well as with legislators, they've all responded very warmly to our requests, and they see it as reasonable and appropriate. And several have said it's time we invest in the university more aggressively.
Let's look at Title IX for a moment. The federal U.S. Department of Education proposed rule changes to how campuses address certain Title IX grievances. And you wrote a letter laying out the strengths and weaknesses of the proposed change. You wrote, "University are not arms of or alternatives to the criminal justice system." What do you mean by that?
Well, Kate, I'd like to give a lecture for the next hour, but I don't think we have that much time. I think...
I'll cut you off.
Okay, please. a lot of people don't understand that the university has a student disciplinary process that is different from a criminal process, and those two are often perceived to be the same. They are not. And in our analysis of the rule change requested by the Department of Education, we believe that so much of what they're trying to impose on the university is to change our disciplinary processes to be more like criminal processes. Now, in some cases, that may be appropriate, but in their instructions, we found some things that I think were more balanced than they had been in the past, but other things we find incredibly difficult. In other words, one of the things we have trouble with, you can't discipline a student for an off-campus behavior, which on a campus that impacts the classroom, that impacts faculty, we have to have that authority to discipline a student. Doesn't mean it's a criminal act necessarily, it's a disciplinary act.
Do you see these proposed rule changes as taking away some of the powers that you have to dictate what happens on your campuses?
I'm not sure I would say it's taking away. I would say that it's trying to turn us into a legal entity, a police arm or something of a more legal nature as opposed to a student disciplinary process. The weight of a criminal act is there clear and convincing evidence that this occurred? And if so, is the accused guilty of that? Is it clear and convincing? Student discipline, I just need the preponderance of the evidence. In other words, if I lay a feather on the scale, it seems more weighted in that direction, and therefore I can discipline in accordance with that kind of a scale. So the differences there, as an example, are important to us.
What facets of the proposed changes would better equip colleges and universities in dealing with sexual harassment and assault?
Well, I do think that there are a couple of things in the proposed rule changes that help to balance this. And in some cases, the previous rules were heavily weighted to benefit the victim. And this brings it into a greater balance between the accused and the victim. However, it also turns both of those into some sort of a legal fight. In our arena, we're not equipped to do that.
We're talking a number of issues with President Ray Cross: deferred maintenance, budgets, tuition costs, major closures, and more. UW System President Ray Cross stays with us. UW System released a report last week indicating nearly 37,000 people completed their degrees in the latest academic year. That's a 13% increase compared to a decade ago. One of the things we're talking about with your questions in the mix at 800-642-1234. Are you a UW alum? What issues do you think your alma mater should prioritize? Would you like the UW to adapt to a changing economy or stay true to the mission of the Wisconsin idea? Can it do both? 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in a minute on the Ideas Network. The UW Board of Regents last week approved tuition hikes for undergraduate and graduate students across the UW system. Graduate tuition will go up at 9 schools. Out-of-state undergraduate tuition will increase at 6 schools. But resident undergraduate tuition has been frozen since 2013. And tuition is one of the topics we're looking at here with UW System President Ray Cross joining us on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What do you want to ask the UW System President? Call in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Jeff now, who's joining us from Kakana. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. Hope everybody gets to work safe this morning.
Hear, hear.
And I guess my question for President Cross would be, we do see that there's a problem with student tuition. Student tuition has gone up at a rate in the past that's far exceeded just about every other sector of our economy. And now President Cross is here seeming to kind of complain because we haven't raised tuition in 8 and 12 years. What's been done differently? What have you done to actually alleviate the cost to the students? Because this is a real problem, and I see you now on here asking for more money for infrastructure and stuff like that, which I admit does probably need to be done. But I don't see anything that's really helping the students. I'm sure they really appreciate, actually, that the tuition's been frozen and hasn't continued to rise.
Jeff, let's see what President Cross has to say about that.
Well, first of all, I do agree that prior to the frozen tuition period beginning in, 2013 or so, that it is true, Jeff, that I think tuition was increasing rather rapidly. And in the late 2000s, before 2010, I know there was a significant spike, Jeff, of 19% 1 year and 13% in the second year, in response to a cut in state aid at that point, state support at that point. So there's been all kinds of juggling on that, and I think that that was probably, in my opinion, inappropriate. Having said all of that, though, we're doing several things. You mentioned frozen tuition, and whether it's frozen or should be growing at the rate of inflation or something that is connected to the average earnings of people of Wisconsin. You have to remember that since 2000, maybe 2000 to 2013, wages in this state and in every state for the most part, with few exceptions, wages were stagnant. They just were not growing. They were flat. And at the same time, we were increasing tuition. So your point is well taken. However, we are doing a number of things. The restructuring is in part due to a reduction in enrollment from demographics as well as a reduction in available funds. So I think that's a fair criticism of us. I would argue that this is still one of the best buys you will find anywhere. It's an incredible buy for a quality education. And we don't want to put that in jeopardy, but as inflation now starts to go up, we have to respond to that in a way that allows us to retain and attract the best faculty in the world, regardless of what institution you're attending. We also have to have the kinds of experiences and the learning experiences that allow students to be retained. And as Kate mentioned earlier, our graduation numbers are up. We're graduating more students, even though we have fewer enrollees. So we're doing a better job of putting students through the process, through the educational pipeline, getting them into the talent pipeline. And some of that's due to the implementation of high-impact practices. Those kinds of things cost a little bit of money, but they actually result in a higher quality education and greater impact.
Let's take a look at the program closures and the majors. UW-Stevens Point plans to cut 6 majors, and UW-Superior suspended 25 majors. What kind of impact do you think this will have on the success of the UW system?
Well, this is an area I'd like to have another hour to talk about. The closure of programs happens all along. We close about 3 programs for every 5 we bring on. So it's not an uncommon thing. I think what's different about this is that they're concentrated in several of the liberal arts areas. And the perception is that we are doing away with that. And quite candidly, at no point in the history of this country have we ever needed the kind of education that liberal arts provides infused into the specializations of the professions. We need people who are critical thinkers, who understand logical fallacies and circular logic, who can communicate effectively in every profession. And unfortunately, we see evidence that too few of those have that ability. So one of the arguments at Stevens Point, which is, I think, an excellent argument, and I don't want to weigh in on the results of that because what they propose to do has not come to me yet. They've been dealing with it rightfully through a process on the campus collaboratively with faculty and the community. But I think what they're trying to do is find ways to more effectively integrate the liberal arts into the professions. Rather than just sending them over to take a course, How does someone majoring in forestry or natural resources understand the history of forest management in this country? How do we get in this position? History is such a contextual thing, and it's so important in every profession. And I could go on and on here, so I won't do that, Kate. But you're
saying you need to integrate the humanities into the majors that are already out there that are not going to be cut.
Much more deeply than I think we have all across the country. And several experts have talked to me about this, and they hope our experiment works really well, because if it does, I think we'll create a better educated populace.
So last year, UW made a big adjustment of the restructuring, which you had just mentioned. What used to be two-year UW colleges are now satellite campuses for nearby four-year universities. Can you give us an update on that process and how it's rolled out?
Surprisingly, and I would keep knocking on wood here, it's gone really well. And that's because so many people have embraced it and are making it work. The Higher Learning Commission had came and visited us for accreditation purposes to evaluate just that. They were very complimentary of what we had done and very, very encouraging. So we're going to complete the first phase by June 30th, and we go into the second phase. We're very methodically approaching this in a way that hopefully does not in any way impact students. And we want to be as gracious and as supportive as we can of our faculty and staff.
Let's go to the phones now with Sarah joining us from Madison with thoughts. Sarah, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to, I guess, maybe make more of a comment. I graduated from the UW system in 2003 with my nursing degree. It's now 2018. I'm still paying off my student loans. It's upsetting to me that we have students graduating with debilitating debt, and I see the coaches of the UW system making millions of dollars. I see President Cross bringing in between $500,000 and $600,000 a year, and we have people, doctors who are graduating, and they can't even afford to practice general practice because their salary isn't enough to pay off their student loans. And I'm wondering how a price increase is going to help our healthcare crisis and how he can justify his salary and the salary of his coaches.
And Sarah graduated with a nursing degree in 2003, still paying off those student loans as a nurse.
Yeah, and Sarah, I have empathy for that. I don't want to speak inappropriately in regard to that because I think some of my kids do as well. So let me respond to it in a couple ways. First of all, years ago, the government provided more grants, and so there were fewer loans, and so the growth of student debt is in some way part to the federal government's changes in the way it deals with loans and grants. Providing more loans and fewer grants. That's one thing. The second is, I think that what we're trying to do in terms of tuition is control our cost and also be very responsive to students, and you're seeing that in the restructure and in other ways. We're trying to maintain access and affordability. We also are exploring new ways to deal with debt, whether it's an income sharing agreement or other tools. And what is an income sharing agreement where a business or an employer, in your case, a hospital or nursing operation, would actually pay, agree to loan you money and while you're attending college. And if you went to work for them, they would pay that off for you as you during your years of employment. So there are a number of tools that we are looking at to reduce debt and help you deal with that. I would also argue that the market is what drives a lot of these up, and I think that's something a lot of people don't understand. And
President Cross, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Ray Cross is president of the University of Wisconsin System. We've been talking about issues concerning the UW, including how to address aging infrastructure. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.